Today is Monday, May 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, a rocket has fired into the Iraqi capital's heavily fortified green zone on Sunday night.
It was shortly after sunset when a rocket struck the heavily fortified green zone in Baghdad.
Also, why South Korea may end up on the losing side of the U.S.-China trade standoff. British Prime Minister Theresa May still hopes for a Brexit deal, and we learn what happens to old neon signs once their shine has faded in Las Vegas. These stories and more ahead on today's International Edition. According to an Iraqi military spokesman, a rocket was fired into the Iraqi capital's heavily fortified green zone on Sunday night, landing less than a mile from the sprawling U.S. embassy. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack. And earlier, I spoke with journalist Sinan Mahmoud, who's in Baghdad. I started off our conversation by discussing what the attack was like.
It was shortly after sunset when a rocket struck the heavily fortified green zone in Baghdad, where the key government offices and Western embassies are located. According to the Iraqi security forces, it was a Katyusha rocket landed in an open area near the statue of the unknown soldier, just like less than a mile from the strong U.S. embassy in Baghdad inside the green zone. No casualties there, according to the security forces in Baghdad. And later they found a rocket launcher in the Shia-dominated eastern part of Baghdad, where the Iran-backed Shia militias are located or have a significant presence there. That's all we know so far.
Is the Iraqi military indicating that they believe the militia may be responsible for this attack?
Well, they didn't put it clearly, but when they say it was fired from the eastern part of Baghdad, they are implicitly referring to the Shia militias. The attack comes amid the escalating tension between U.S. and Iran, and which started earlier this month, and also like a few days from evacuating non-essential staff from the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, fearing threats or possible threats from Iran-backed Shias against Americans in Baghdad. So if we connect today's attack with other two attacks in Saudi Arabia a few days ago and United Arab Emirates, it could tell us something about any potential rule for the Shia militia.
You mentioned the escalating tension in the Gulf. As someone who is in Baghdad, is the tension palpable?
Everything is palpable in Baghdad or in Iraq in general. Everyone is playing with fire here in Baghdad. No one is really controlling the Shia militia, even the Iraqi government. So you can't predict.
Have authorities, whether they be Iraqi military authorities or anyone from the U.S. diplomatic mission there, given an indication as to what they may do to further increase security in and around the green zone?
No, but they closed the main road into the green zone immediately. It was almost late in Baghdad when it struck the heavily fortified green zone. All Baghdad residents were indoors after breaking their fast during the holy month of Ramadan. So there could be something tomorrow morning, new security measures or something like that.
That was reporter Sinan Mahmoud in Baghdad. 12 people, mostly South African tourists, have been injured in an explosion targeting a bus that was headed for Egypt's Giza pyramids. Reuters' David Doyle has those details.
12 people, mostly South Africans, have been injured in an explosion targeting a tourist bus in Egypt, according to security sources. They said Sunday's blast took place near a museum being built close to the Giza pyramids. This witness is saying he was in a car right behind the bus and that all the foreigners in the front were injured. A security source said the vehicle was carrying 25 South Africans from the airport to the pyramids area. The explosion occurring a few hundred meters from the Grand Egyptian Museum, due to open next year. Four Egyptians in a nearby car were injured by broken glass. Egyptian security forces are waging a counter-insurgency campaign against Islamist militants, some with links to Islamic State, that is focused in the north of the Sinai Peninsula, though attacks outside Sinai have been relatively rare. In December, three Vietnamese tourists and an Egyptian tour guide were killed, at least 10 others injured, when a roadside bomb hit their tour bus near the Giza pyramids.
That was Reuters reporter David Doyle. Switzerland will adopt tighter gun control, steering the country away from a clash with the European Union. In a binding referendum on Sunday, voters agreed by a margin of nearly 2-1 to bring Swiss gun laws in line with the EU. After militants killed scores of people in Paris in 2015, it was in 2017 that Brussels toughened laws against buying semi-automatic rifles and made it easier to track weapons in national databases. These restrictions apply to non-EU member Switzerland because it's part of Europe's Schengen open border system. But they had raised concerns among shooting enthusiasts as well as right-wing activists. They complained the rules would disarm law-abiding citizens and damage Switzerland's national identity. But failure to adopt the rule could have forced Switzerland out of the passport-free Schengen zone. And that's something this resident understood.
To me, the new obligations linked to the possession of guns are not that restrictive. It is just that Switzerland has to align itself with the system in which it participates.
The initial EU proposal had provoked outcry because it meant a ban on the Swiss tradition of ex-soldiers keeping their assault rifles. However, Swiss officials negotiated concessions for veterans and gun enthusiasts in the country's numerous shooting clubs. Here are other major stories from around the globe. Tens of thousands of demonstrators opposed to right-wing populism and nationalism took the streets Sunday in a number of European cities before the May 23rd to 26th elections to the European Parliament. Voting in India's national election ended Sunday with the seventh and final phase of a grueling poll that lasted more than 5 weeks. Exit polls indicate that a victory is in store for Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu Nationalist Party and its allies. Sudan's ruling military council is meeting with protesters on Sunday to discuss the country's political transition after talks were halted for 3 days while roads were cleared outside the main sit-in in the capital of Khartoum. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOANews.com website. This is International Edition.
Hello. I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. As U.S. President Donald Trump intensifies his trade battle with China, one of the hardest hit countries could be South Korea. After U.S.-China trade talks broke down, Trump last week raised tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports and threatened to do so with $300 billion more. China retaliated with tariffs on $60 billion of U.S. goods. As Asia's fourth largest economy, South Korea is especially vulnerable to the tariff war because of its reliance on foreign trade, in particular exports to its big trading partners, China and the U.S. To dive deeper into the subject, I spoke with VOA's Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo. I started our conversation by having him explain why South Korea is in a vulnerable position.
Well, it was unexpected, but the first quarter of this year, there was actually a contraction in gross domestic product in South Korea. They have had economic woes, but it wasn't expected to be that bad. I think part of the problem was that China's economy has been suffering, and they're right next door, obviously. And then the other part is that South Korea's economy depends a lot on technology, and in particular, the smartphone industry, which hasn't been doing great lately.
If you take a look at South Korea's economy before this whole U.S.-China trade impasse, is it just the technology sector that was hurting, or were there other factors in play in South Korea?
Well, obviously, South Korea as well as Japan have a very aging society. This is the problem. People are getting old, and the young people can't find jobs. So there were a lot of existing problems before that. But I think the U.S.-China trade war, if you want to call it that, or trade dispute, has sort of exacerbated some of those problems that were already going on.
So it's mainly the U.S.-China situation that is exacerbating things. Is there anything else that the U.S.-China trade discussions are affecting in South Korea?
Well, one of the most impacted industries here is the semiconductor industry. South Korea relies on its exports of technology products, in particular semiconductors, memory chips that go into smartphones and computers and things like that. A lot of the semiconductors that they make here go to China, and then they go on from China into smartphones in China. They're assembled in smartphones in China, and then they get sent to the United States. Well, what has happened with the trade war is that Donald Trump has imposed tariffs on a lot of those products. And those smartphones then become more expensive, which means there are not as many smartphones that are going from China to the United States. That, in turn, means that South Korea won't be sending as many semiconductors to China. It's a bit complicated, but the point is they're really sort of feeling the heat of these tariffs, and it's likely to get quite a bit worse in the near future.
So what are they looking at in terms of projections long term?
Well, it's a little bit complicated to say because while you have seen exports from South Korea take a dive, especially exports to China, what you have seen is that exports from China to the United States have actually increased. And if you look at the tariffed goods, the items on which Donald Trump has placed tariffs, South Korea has been sending more of those to the United States. And it's enough actually to make up for the hit they've taken on the decrease of goods sent to China. So essentially, the situation is this. Donald Trump's tariffs on China may sort of shake up the technology production industry so that more goods are manufactured outside of China. Essentially, these companies are deciding that it is too expensive to make things in China. They're going to do so elsewhere. And that could lead to a lot of long-term impact here in Asia.
You know, one of the things when you talk about elections, it's all about the economy and everything is local, local, local. When you are walking the streets of Seoul and you read South Korean media, how are people there looking at the situation?
Well, that is a tricky question because unlike, Hong Kong or something, not a lot of South Koreans have money invested in the stock market. So while the tariffs have resulted in a hit to big companies like Samsung, and I think HK Hynix is the big other big semiconductor producer, it's not necessarily hitting the common person in South Korea as it relates to that. However, there are other aspects of the economy, I think, that are hurting the average South Korean. Property prices are very high. The won actually has been performing not very good lately, which just... There are a lot of impacts, and I think that there is a lot of pressure on the government here to be able to make some progress on the economy.
That was VOA's Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo speaking with me from South Korea. British Prime Minister Theresa May plans to make a bold offer to Parliament to win support for her Brexit deal, AP correspondent Zaria Shackley reports.
Writing in the Sunday Times, May says her bill will come with an improved package of measures that she believes can win new support. Britain was due to leave the EU on the 29th of March, but the bloc extended the deadline until the 31st of October amid the political impasse. That deadlock deepened between the collapse of cross-party talks and intensifying pressure on May from within the Conservative Party to quit. Cabinet ministers will discuss measures this week aimed at securing cross-party support. Zaria Shakili, London.
A UN watchdog group is demanding an end to the widespread practice of torture and other cruel punishments in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The DRC is one of six countries examined by the UN Committee Against Torture, which monitors the implementation by states of the Convention Against Torture. At the conclusion of its four-week session, the committee criticized the DRC for failing to meet this test. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Democratic Republic of Congo's Minister for Human Rights, Marie-Ange Mushabekwa, offered a vigorous defense of her country's efforts to comply with the provisions of the Convention Against Torture. She argued that following the ratification of the treaty in 2010, her country had adopted a law against torture, which strengthened and completed the penal code. She said measures were being enacted to strengthen the criminalization of torture. But her defense failed to persuade the 18 independent members of the UN Committee Against Torture. Human rights expert Sebastian Touze says evidence presented to the committee indicates the prohibitions enshrined in the convention are being completely ignored by the DRC, legally and in practice. Furthermore, he notes 63% of human rights violations were committed by state agents.
Il en ressort dès lors un sentiment et un climat général d'impunité, c'est-à-dire qu'il n'y a aucune poursuite qui sont ouvertes contre.
He says there is a general climate of impunity in DRC. He says no one suspected of human rights violations is prosecuted, allowing torture and other cruel acts to flourish. He says victims of abuse are abandoned and have no recourse to justice. In its report, the committee notes that arbitrary detention is widespread. It finds secret detention centers continue to exist, in which the majority of detainees there are victims of torture and cruel and degrading treatment. Those most at risk of abuse, it says, include human rights defenders, journalists, and political dissidents. The UN committee reports violence against women is widespread. And while rape and sexual violence, including mass rape, are endemic in situations of conflict, it says the 2011 law in DRC does not recognize these atrocities as acts of torture. The experts express great concern about the numerous human rights violations received by the committee. They have asked the DRC delegation to report back within a year on steps being taken to bring the country into compliance with the Torture Convention. Minister Mushabekwa said her country was not in denial about its checkered human rights record. She said the government is doing all it can to fight impunity against torture, but things take time. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Later this week, U.S. officials are expected to brief lawmakers on what has led the Trump administration to strengthen America's military posture in the Middle East, while evacuating non-essential personnel from diplomatic facilities in Iraq. VOA's Michael Bowman reports members of Congress of both parties have been demanding the White House share information about perceived threats from Iran.
In word and deed, the Trump administration has been sounding the alarm over Iran and its proxies.
If American interests are attacked, we will most certainly respond in an appropriate fashion.
Lawmakers are demanding more information.
And I would urge the State Department and DOD to come down here and explain to us what's going on, because I have no idea what the threat stream is beyond what I read in the paper.
We need clarity. We need answers, and we need them now.
Asked if war with Iran is on the horizon, President Donald Trump would only say, some fear a repeat of the buildup to the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq.
We do not need another Iraq weapons of mass destruction moment that led us to one of the worst disastrous military engagements when there were no weapons of mass destruction to be found.
Words of advice from a former commander of U.S. forces in Iraq: America should seek to change Iran's behavior, not regime change in Iran.
The idea of invading, I think, is something that is certainly not seriously on the table. We should have learned by now, I think, especially after the Arab Spring, that the regime change aftermath is not always what we have hoped it would be.
For now, many Republicans are willing to give the administration the benefit of the doubt, given Iran's past actions.
I support what the administration is doing with regard to reinforcing our military capabilities in the region, and this is the reason. It sends a message to Iran that if you're going to try and do what you did in 2004, 2005, and 2006, which is kill and wound thousands of our military members, that we are going to have the capability to make you pay.
It's very straightforward. If Iran attacks, there'll be a war. If Iran does not attack, there will not be a war.
Many Democrats, meanwhile, are reserving judgment.
I just want to confirm what the purpose of our pressure campaign is. Many of us feel that it's been ham-handed without a well-defined end game.
The American people deserve to know what's going on. If the president and Republicans in Congress are planning to take the United States to a conflict, even a war in the Middle East, the American people deserve to know that, and they deserve to know why.
Congressional leaders received classified briefings late last week. Briefings for rank-and-file lawmakers of both parties reportedly are being planned in the days to come. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Every year, astronomers are seeing farther and more clearly into the cosmos than ever before. One of the ways they're doing it is by linking telescopes together to make them more powerful. Their very large array in New Mexico, supported by the National Science Foundation, is one incredible example. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
Welcome to the Very Large Array, or VLA as it is called. It's a complex of 27 massive antennas in New Mexico, all pointing skyward.
We use the Very Large Array, which we operate from the plains of San Agustin in New Mexico, to study the radio emission from the cosmos.
With support from the National Science Foundation, astronomers like Claire Chandler are using this facility to observe the universe. Star birth, star death, black holes, colliding galaxies, these and more are all in a day's work at the VLA.
What the radio does is that it reveals those physical processes in ways that you simply can't see in the optical and the infrared.
You may be thinking the VLA detects sound. Not exactly, says Mark McKinnon, who oversees operations for the VLA in New Mexico.
There's a bit of a disconnect in that radio waves are not heard. Acoustic waves are what we hear with our ears. And that's the distinction, is a radio wave is still a part of the electromagnetic spectrum, just at a much longer wavelength than what our eyes are accustomed to seeing.
Interpreting radio images can be challenging. They often look like a lot of blobs, but to the trained eye, they have a lot to tell.
This is actually an image of an elliptical galaxy that was observed with the Hubble Space Telescope. So the pink emission here that you see is actually the radio emission. All of this energetic plasma that's being spewed out of that supermassive black hole in the center of that galaxy, which we would not even know about if we didn't have the VLA.
A main focus of Chandler's research, star formation, which happens inside vast clouds of gas containing hydrogen and other molecules.
This is a simulation, a computer simulation of what we think the collapse of a molecular cloud might look like. And it was done, it was published over 15 years ago now.
See those swirls? Astronomers theorized that this is what starbirth looks like. But for a long time, they didn't have actual observations to confirm it. Advances in radio astronomy changed that.
You can see exactly that swirling material, just like the simulation. And, you know, this was the first time we'd ever seen this.
Understanding the mechanics of the universe by deciphering its radio emissions. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
In the American Southwest, there is one city that literally lights up the night. Las Vegas. And if you take a trip to the famed city, you will see scores of neon signs and other animated images all along Las Vegas Boulevard, Fremont Street, and elsewhere. But the city in the desert has undergone many changes over the years, and in fact, I went to university just a few hours away from the city and would often visit friends and family. And since my college days, many of the casinos and hotels that were present in my youth have vanished. The Las Vegas Neon Museum has been lighting up the city since 2012. That's when activists, art lovers, and local officials decided that neon signs that have seen better days deserved to be viewed and enjoyed by a new generation of tourists. Roman Mamanov traveled to Las Vegas and visited this unusual museum.
It's hard to imagine Las Vegas without this yellow, green, and red neon signs. A cheap yet effective way for owners of local businesses and casinos to attract tourists, neon signs have long been an integral part of the city's gambling industry. But even these bright signs lose their shine. Instead of being thrown away, they are finding a new home in Las Vegas Neon Museum, which opened in 2012.
We received signs from YESCO, Young Electric Sign Company. They had a boneyard, and you'll see a lot of the boneyard signs in movies and films and music videos. However, I would say the start of this collection, about 30% at that time, was from YESCO's boneyard.
These signs and logos have a history. The oldest dates back to the Prohibition era of the 1920s. Another unique sign comes from Riviera Hotel, which were demolished in 2016.
So the Riviera was very conscious of their legacy, and we're so proud of them for reaching out to us and making sure we got wonderful pieces of signage. That Riviera piece you see up there, it was in great working order, so we were able to, we like to joke, plug it in.
However, for most museum visitors, these artifacts are simply the great backdrop for the fun social media posts.
But I just find it interesting that these are so old and they had these bright flashing lights from so long ago, and I just the way that they're rusting and it's sort of new and old at the same time, I find really fascinating.
This place may not resemble a typical art museum filled with sculptures and paintings, but it's Las Vegas after all, and neon signs here are an integral part of the local culture. Roman Mamanov in Las Vegas, Nevada, VOA News.
The Netherlands is the winner of the 2019 Eurovision Song Contest. Duncan Lawrence's doleful piano ballad, Arcade, was tapped as an early frontrunner before Saturday's grand final, but it had to rely on the fan votes to secure the country's fifth win in the competition. However, it is the first Eurovision victory for the country since the 1970s. Speaking later at a press conference in the capital, Duncan Lawrence expressed hope that the win would be a start for his professional music career.
Dit was mijn droom. Dit is mijn droom nog steeds, en hij is uitgekomen.
He said this was and is still his dream, and it came true. He dared to dream and dared to do it. His victory means the Netherlands will host next year's competition. Around 200 million people around the world were believed to have watched the annual contest, which debuted in the wake of World War II. Italy finished second, followed by Russia, Switzerland, and Norway. And that's going to do it for us today. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, videos, stories, and more, be sure to follow Voice of America on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget to download our mobile application to take the stories with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a magnificent Monday.
This is VOA News.